Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. People come to see me when they can't figure out why they feel poorly. The first things I look at are how they're eating, their sensitivities, possible family history considerations and vulnerabilities, and what they're exposed to at home and at work. An old friend of mine, who listens to my show online from the East Coast, asked me, for instance, why she should be worried about her drinking water. I've learned that people are affected by things they don't expect to be, and that the accumulated exposures do lead to possible illnesses. Certainly the goal of health education isn't to scare you into becoming obsessive about your world so that it's no longer pleasurable. But if there are things you can do to protect yourself, wouldn't you want the choice? Today we'll be talking about what constitutes a healthy indoor environment in the context of a healthy home inspection. I'm joined by Jeff Fawcett, PhD, an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who works with individuals and does healthy home inspections. He co-produces this radio show and is the editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. So, well, welcome to the show, which you produce.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. People respond to the environment in extremely different ways. I think it would be good if you can help us understand the difference between an immune response versus a toxic response.
A couple of issues ago, I wrote an article in the Progressive Health Observer about the rise in allergies and particularly asthma. This has become a worldwide concern. And the research I discuss in that article points to is that we have not only become exposed to more irritants, that is, allergens, things that affect our immune systems, but also that our immune systems have become more sensitive. That's clearly what research that I've seen shows. So the question is, what's causing that increased sensitivity? To switch to toxicants, or toxins in our environment, this latest issue of the Quarterly has an article about toxic load and how health disparities between England and the United States could be looked at as a difference in the exposures that Americans have, or longer exposures Americans have had, to toxins in their environment. Now, one of the things that I think may link these things together is a theory that's in the environmental health field that's called toxic induced loss of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. The concept there is that someone becomes chemically sensitive. This is what the theory is focused on, but it compares to a couple of other prominent health issues, that someone becomes chemically sensitive by experiencing a severe exposure to some toxin.
Or a cumulative exposure, no?
Well, this particular theory says that there's a dramatic, it could be cumulative or it could be acute, but that there's a severe reaction and that affects the person's system. Subsequently, the person reacts severely not to extreme exposures, but to very small exposures,
yes,
and not just to the single toxicant that they were initially exposed to, but all manner of toxicants. Now, it turns out that one of this theory was put forth almost 10 years ago by a MD who's director of an environmental health program at the University of Texas in San Antonio named Claudia Miller. Her view was to look at things like Gulf War syndrome, asthma, and compare those to how those lined up with this hypothesis of how chemical sensitivities come about. And one of the things that she notes is that with this increased sensitivity, the person's system becomes so oversensitized that it's not possible to tell what exactly they're reacting to. So what she's proposed to do is to do experiments that creates a clean environment in which to see, in which to, people who are sensitive can be analyzed in terms of what is it exactly that they are reacting to.
The other thing that I saw happen a lot during the 80s, during the environmental ecology movement, where a lot of people were suddenly becoming environmentally sensitive, is that people would have cumulative exposures to things over time. And I would say that Gulf War syndrome or any of these other things are cumulative exposures. You know, I mean, sometimes we think it's a big wham right. of an exposure, but it's still an accumulation of several things, and it may have been over time. And the theory at that point was that what happens is specifically that certain toxins destroy your suppressor cells in the immune system so that your attacker cells kind of go right. after everything. They just can't. So there's some issue about whether toxic exposure, in fact, destroys part of the immune system, part of the cells that mediate hypervigilance. And that may be part of the reason that this is happening.
Well, part of what we're seeing and part of Claudia Miller's hypothesis is that particularly with respect to the relation, what physicians who work in environmental health are seeing is that the symptoms that present for their patients are so complex that it's impossible to tease them apart, and that we're really dealing with a fairly complex environmental and biological interaction, so that people who are, one important aspect to this is a recognition that some people are more susceptible than others to this, call it a toxic shock that kicks their system into this hypervigilant state, which in principle is not different, particularly from an infectious disease. Some people are more susceptible than others. But the big difference here is in terms of a concept of illness, that unlike the disease model, in which some agent causes a disease and then the body develops either antibodies or becomes infectious, this turns the body on so that it becomes hypervigilant and overreactive.
I think the reason for even bothering to discuss any of this, since we're not talking, this is not a show about multiple chemical sensitivities per se, and but one of the reasons for bringing this up is that what people don't understand is that your exposures are, as we've said so many times on the air, they're antagonists in the environment. There are chemicals and things that you're exposed to that act in synergy with each other, that cause stronger reactions than any one of them by themselves. And then that's a concern. And then just the idea that over time, the things that you're not aware that you're being exposed to are still acting on your immune system. And people really never even think of this until their immune system crashes for some reason, or they have an accumulation of really irritating symptoms that they can't explain, like a constant drip in the back of their throat, or right. Asthma, or indigestion, or foggy-brained stuff, hyperactivity in children, even potentially extreme reactions like autism and other things that might look psychiatric in nature. So the point is that I feel, and you feel, I believe, that if people are more precise in the way that they look at their environment, it's a little bit like tending a garden or something, there's a chance that you can have some effect. And again, I want people to listen to the information in this show without feeling overwhelmed. Just remember that whatever you can do to reduce your overall load is going to help. It isn't possible to live. You're not going to, unless you are extremely chemically sensitive and you're already living in a controlled environment. Most of the rest of the people in the world who are not maybe predisposed to be that sensitive or haven't had a massive exposure. Some people have a lot of exposure and get sick over time. Nurses, for instance, doctors sometimes.
Yes, right.
Is that you just want to be prudent in the choices that you make. So approaching this idea of a healthy home inspection, how would you start?
Well, the first place I start is with a questionnaire, even off-site, before you even show up. And a questionnaire is just to get a sense of what the building is like, what the general environment is like, how old is the house, is it an apartment, is it close to other buildings, is it close to industrial areas, so that it's kind of the second part is when I show up, when I actually approach the site, I can examine, take a look at what's around. I can see
it's location.
Okay, that's right. Well, except it's not quite real estate, but to examine things like what's the traffic like in the area, how close is it to major arteries where air pollution is going to be affecting the air quality, or both around the house and what the house breathes in. What are the electrical lines like in the area? Where are those things located? Are there cell phone towers that I can see in the area? What's that exposure? At the site itself, I'll take a look at the actual exterior, the environment of the building itself. Things like landscaping. Is there evidence of use of pesticides and herbicides? Does the building show any exterior signs of damage? Is it vented both in the underneath and above? Do the windows and doors look like they're well sealed? Does it look like there's any evidence of drainage problems on the site itself?
So part of what you're looking for is where are the potential exposures coming from, even before you walk inside to the indoor?
Yes, indeed, because the whole business about window closures and ventilation affect two of the most important things that are going to be going on in the house. One is water infiltration, and the other is how air moves from the outside into the interior of the building, and how heat's regulated in the building.
It would also seem that if there is, like for instance, in the extreme, when you say you want to see what's around the house and what kind of vegetation's around the house, in the extreme, there are people who live on golf courses. And golf courses are sprayed all the time with herbicides and whatnot to keep them looking the way they're looking, like carpet. So the issue here is not only what comes in through the windows, but what you carry in on your feet.
Perhaps even on your clothing.
And, you know, one of the reasons for being this precise about what you're being exposed to, or being more conscious of it, paying more attention to it, is that children are very much at risk in a way that adults aren't, just by the size of their bodies. And I think we've said that enough times on the show.
And another way of saying that is, to state the obvious, kids are built closer to the ground. And the ground is where a lot of this stuff hides out. It's also in the house where a lot of this stuff hides out. The other thing to look for, that I look for on the exterior of buildings, is if there are any structures like decks or play structures that are made out of treated wood. Treated wood can be and traditionally is either can have petroleum-based products, which can be toxic, or preservatives, which often have arsenic in them, which is toxic.
And then there's also the plasticized wood products, too, which I think still continue to outgas in the sun.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you heat a plastic up, and it will tend to outgas. And this is both the pure plastic materials and also the composite materials.
I just want to remind people who are listening, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in the studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're talking about healthy home inspections. Dr. Fawcett is an environmental economist and a writer, health educator, and he does healthy home inspections. And we're discussing them today, what they compromise, what they are comprised of. And so one of the things also about looking at the outside of the house, along with looking at ventilation under the house and whatnot, is that there's an issue about whether or not there's moisture too close to the house. So I would think also the drainage situation and whether or not people are carrying drainage away from right. the drain pipes, because there's, depending on where you live, there can be a lot of standing water, and that means that you're going to have mold. A lot of mold.
Yes. Well, another issue is what the exterior material is.
In terms of mold?
Well, in terms of mold and water penetration.
Yeah.
What is the what's the exterior of the house made of, and what are the joints at the various parts of the house?
Now, you know, we're talking about all of this, and we haven't even gone inside, and people are probably holding their heads and going, oh, Lord, there's just too many things. But all of these things can be addressed in one way or another. I mean, the idea here is not to, again, overwhelm people, but to remind people that things can be changed and addressed.
Yeah, simple example, if you have a pristine, if you live in an apartment building and you have a pristine lawn that has no dandelions in it, don't walk on it. Walk on the sidewalk.
Yeah, but you might want to find out what they're using.
No, certainly you want to find out what they're using, but I'm just saying as an example in terms of prudent avoidance.
You're saying if you're renting.
Yes,
if
you're renting. But it is, as you say, wise to understand what it is that the gardeners are using on the lawns to make them
Well, that's the biggest
pristine.
Complaint is that some people don't own property and they feel like they don't have control over their environment, but you can choose your environment. Let's unpack some of the stuff before we move inside. You know, occasionally I'll get a call from somebody who will say, I'm proximal to a power line and I'm terrified. So can we give people some idea of what kinds of power lines, at least visually looking at them, before you take out a Gauss meter, what sorts of things are you looking for, if you want to do an immediate visual inspection for yourself?
The first thing to look for, literally, is how far apart the actual wires themselves are, and that will give you some indication as to how much voltage is being carried through the lines. Generally, distribution lines to houses are fairly low voltage. However, if you do live in an area with a large tower, the rule of thumb is the higher the pole or tower on which the lines run and the further apart the lines are on the tower, the higher the voltage, the higher the power that's going through the lines, the higher the electromagnetic field. So a normal power line, if it's far enough from a house, is in terms of once you get a Gauss meter, or you can get a utility to come out and measure it at your house, you want exposures, or where you spend a lot of your time, to be around 1 to 2 milligauss. That's the exposure that you want. Another thing to look for.
Well, but you should.
Yes.
I think it's wise to explain that the reason is not because 2 milligauss is an acceptable level for you to be exposed to all the time, but because there's a lot of fall off as you get to your house. So if you are inspecting a house, you can take the Gauss meter and see what the Gauss, you know, what the Gauss
what
reading is, and then see
inside.
What's inside the house.
Right.
You know, so that's a reason for not freaking out.
Yes.
Because a lot of residential neighborhoods have power lines that are not enormous, you know, carrying enormous loads on them. So
the other thing to look for on power poles are transformers, which most of them look like little cylinders that are perched up on the poles themselves, and those things transform the electricity, power it down so it can be distributed to your drop box, which is somewhere on your house.
That's another thing to look at, isn't it? Where the drop box is in relationship to living space.
That's particularly important with regard to an issue we'll talk about a little bit later called dirty electricity, which is a problem with surges in the power frequencies that come through the power lines. And all of that, those surges, come directly through the breaker box where your the power is distributed to your house. It comes down from the power lines. So knowing where that is and knowing where your activities are on the interior of the house is going to be very helpful, because that's something you want to avoid.
Cell phone towers might be an exception to the rule of drop-off. Is that, what's the deal with how close, is there an issue with, we talked about power lines and proximity to power lines. Is it the same deal with cell phone towers, or are they more pervasive in terms of their
well, anything that's sending out
field,
that's sending out, well, in the case of cell towers, radio frequency radiation, is the closer you are, the more powerful the signal. That's what the drop-off is. Anything that's sending a signal, the power that it's in order to reach you has to be high at the source so that it will get to you, because there's that effect of dropping a pebble in the pond and the waves get smaller and smaller as they go outward, and they get smaller and smaller at an increasing rate. So the closer a cell antenna or cell tower is to you, the more exposure you have. Some people have discovered that there's a very fine movie by Doug Loringer called
Bad Reception.
Bad Reception, right. In which there's one of the interviewees is a man who discovers that there's a cell antenna on the other side of the wall from his child's crib. And is quite astounded.
Okay, so we've been looking outside of the house. We've been looking at how the house is set up to handle moisture. We're looking at what its proximity is to ambient radiation from electromagnetic fields from power lines and radio frequency radiation from cell phone towers. Because these, again, the principle here is it's all cumulative, and it's one thing on top of another that affects you. So my sense is that maybe it makes sense to think first in terms of, since we're talking about moisture, thinking in terms of mold, because I know that most people who have been pretty careful about their home environment and what products they use in the home may still have a mold problem in the house. And mold is really a moisture problem.
Yes, exactly.
So
that's the hospitable environment. The deal with mold and other critters that cause problems has to do with creating or having a hospitable environment for them. And for molds, moisture and darkness are their friends.
Yeah.
So just in terms of examining where there are opportunities for molds, those are going to be the places where it's moist and where it's dark. And that suggests what the actions you can take to improve that situation are, which is to remove the moisture, remove either sources of infiltration of moisture, and increase light. Expose areas that lack light to something, and not fluorescent bulbs either, incandescent bulbs. For instance, like laundry closets and so on, places that
bathrooms
are notorious. Places like bathrooms may present particular problems because they're constantly moist. So instead of using toxic mildewcides, there are some very simple things that you can use to get rid of molds.
Well, first of all, let's figure out how you know you've got it. And I think the first step is whether or not you smell a musty smell. And I think people are sort of accept the idea that older houses will have a musty smell, or older apartments will have a musty smell. And that's actually not a good sign if there's a musty smell.
No.
And I wonder if, my experience is that the first thing I do is look to see whether it's coming from, if it's coming from the walls, you're in trouble, because that's a big job to get rid of it. But sometimes it's not even the walls. Sometimes it's coming from the carpeting or as you say, from different cabinets and things like that. I mean, it's or magazines and books.
Yes, which is there are lots of places it can hide. And in a way, following your nose is a way to identify where this is located.
If you have a good nose, or just really paying attention to how much accumulated old stuff you've got that might be getting it moist. You know, so in other words, if you don't keep your house, the ambient temperature in your house at least 60 degrees during the winter, it's going to get moldy. So people who completely turn off their heat to save money sometimes end up in a moldy house. I mean, one trick is to keep some lights on.
Yes.
Even if they're 40-watt bulbs. Just to 'cause if you have control over your environment, there, you know, we've talked about the outside of the house and how you can protect yourself by having enough ventilation under the house and above the house and having ventilation in the house. But if you don't have control over your environment, then it behooves you to really pay close attention to what's on the floors, what's on the walls, what's in your bookcases, not letting things sort of languish and get moist, and keeping the house, you know, warm enough.
If it's a freestanding house, there's also, if you have a basement or a crawl space,
you need
to check that out.
It has to be vented.
Because it both needs to be vented. That's another thing that molds do not like. They do not like free-flowing air. And make sure that moisture is not collecting under there, and that molds will grow on any surface. As long as those environmental conditions of moisture and darkness, they have that.
In fact, the first place people usually see the kind of mold that we really worry about the most, which is black mold, which is black, is around their window frames. Even if they're doing everything else pretty well, if you're heating the house, around the window frames, especially old window sashes, you'll see black accumulating. And what's interesting about that is that the easiest thing to do in that situation is to get hold of either your little mixture of stuff, or to use hydrogen peroxide right from the 3% that you buy right from the pharmacy, put a pair of gloves on, and just douse that area with the hydrogen peroxide, you know, with a Q-tip or with, and clean it out, clean out the black whenever you see it there. So there's some ways that, you know, but aside from smelling, I mean, there is that terrible situation where people actually see
Yes.
Well, under paintings and things.
Yeah, there's a visual inspection behind the bookcases, behind anything that's hanging on the walls. You're not going to see it in rugs. It might be growing underneath rugs. That would be actually pretty serious infestation.
Oh, it happens a lot, though.
Oh, I'm sure.
Or the underlayment to flooring material. If you've got, I did this in a house where there was carpeting and there was underlayment under the carpeting, and the underlayment was fiberboard, which is really porous. And so that stuff was completely moldy.
Oh, sure.
And we had to pull it up. We need to take, we have about 1 minute, but we're very close to needing to take a brief break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Healthy home inspections is our topic today. We're going to take just a brief musical break. When we come back, we'll return to this interview about healthy home inspections. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, in studio today with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're discussing healthy home inspections. If you missed parts of today's show and you want to get a copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, or if you want to listen to a full hour version of this show all week long, you can go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer. And you can also call The main number for us is 707-874-2772. If you'd like to get hold of Dr. Fawcett for health inspections or whatever, health education, it's 707-874-1496, 874-1496 in the 707. We are talking about mold here and avoiding having a hospitable environment for it, and also cleaning it off when you see it. We had gotten as far as yikes underneath the underlayment on your floor. Also, if you have a basement apartment, to your concrete slab. So what do you do if you're not going, let's put it this way, if you own the house, you can make some decisions about what's on your floor. You can pull things up. You can, certainly you're always better off with flooring that's more natural, doesn't have chemicals in it, hardwood floorings that are finished prudently or whatever. But because carpeting really is just sort of asking for it. Between the dust and the mold, you're just asking for it.
Yes, it gets it gets trapped. The way that molds reproduce, the spread is through spores, and they grow and they pop the spores, and the spores get lodged all around. And you walk on a carpet, for instance, on a carpet, and you walk on the carpet, and that kicks up dust, and it kicks the spores up, and then the spores get spread.
And babies are climbing around on the carpet.
Babies are climbing around on the carpet. So there's levels that you can do to fix these mold problems. As I said, the first thing to do is to create an inhospitable environment, which is to get rid of moisture. And that may take some analyzing. Why you may just live in a moist climate. When I lived in Santa Cruz, I had a dehumidifier that took literally pints a day out of each room. And worked fairly effectively at keeping the mold at bay. Barring that, you may have to look at how water is infiltrating into various areas. You may have a water intrusion problem underneath your house, which is how drainage around the house is an important issue when this comes up, because if water next to the house is not being drained away, it's going to seep underneath.
And then you have wet soil under the house, so it's probably a good idea to seal off whatever is under the house with maybe a visqueen, and then also put some insulation under the floor or something.
Well, insulation is going to help the heating in the floor in the house itself. I don't know that it's going
to
help
the mold
problem.
You have to be careful what you use, actually.
Well, you have to be careful with the insulation, but also the insulation becomes a medium, which is one of the problems that you can have if mold gets into the insulation in the exterior walls of a house. If you do have insulation in the exterior walls of the house, mold can get in there, spores can get in there and start growing, in which case that's serious, pretty serious business.
How do you know if that's happening?
That I know of, the only way to know is to actually inspect it. The safest way is to drill a hole in the wall and if you have a sensitive nose, you'll pretty much know when you open that hole up, which is something to be extremely careful about when you open that up.
Yeah, you do have to be careful. The other thing is that if you see mold growing on the wall, as you say, behind pictures is where you often see it.
And if it is growing behind a picture, you need to not only clean off the wall, you need to clean off the back of the frame and the picture itself, particularly if it's absorbent material. And you may have to do it periodically because it's those spores are very persistent.
You have a pretty good cleaning solution that you discovered.
Yeah, this thing works very well. It's fairly simple and it's non-toxic. Take a pint of water, mix about half a teaspoon of tea tree oil and a teaspoon of grapefruit seed extract, and shake it up and spray it on areas that are moldy. And you can do that around windows. You can use it as a replacement for mildicides in bathrooms.
Cars,
kitchens,
too.
Cars, yep. So that's a very handy little and cheap. Well, the materials aren't that cheap, but the quantities in which you use them, it becomes a cheap method of controlling the molds.
Borax is also a good moldicide,
yes.
And hydrogen peroxide, 3%, and bleach, but bleach, people are allergic to bleach. So along with mold spores hiding behind things and in things, we have this issue of dust. This is really, you know, part of the deal here is that people really do need to vacuum once a week or so, and I know people really get busy, but dust mites are pretty hard on a lot of people.
It turns out that it's not so much the dust mites themselves, which are little spiders. It's the feces of the dust mites.
What they leave behind.
What they leave behind, which you can see floating around in the air on a nice sunny day when the sunlight casts its glow through the windows.
That's what we see.
Those little dust motes. Yes, indeed. That's what it is. Or that's one of the things that it is. And as you walk through a room.
Flea poop.
It's not flea poop. But, there's probably some flea poop in there, too. But it's.
Dust poop is what I mean.
Dust mite poops. In some areas, they're called spider mites, by the way. Interestingly enough, the control of dust mites is actually somewhat similar to controlling molds. That is, vacuum the heck out of your carpets and rugs, and reduce humidity. Dust mites get their water from humidity in the air. So if you reduce humidity below 50%, the little buggers dry up. Bedding and towels and those sorts of things, but particularly bedding also has dust mites. So washing that out helps control that problem.
Some of the ionizing air purifiers that do not produce ozone will make dust fall to the ground.
Yes,
which makes it a little easier to get rid of.
Yeah, you just need a good vacuum cleaner to. Suck that stuff up.
But it does make you pause and think about how many things you want to dust in your house and how much you want rugs on the floor and how big the rug should be and whether or not it's washable. Sometimes a washable rug is a good idea, too, so you can get rid of it. Again, children. There are other creatures that we have to worry about. People who are very conscious and careful often still spray insecticides in their house. And some people just out of frustration run around with essential oil sprays and soap. But there are better ways of getting rid of them. And one of them goes back to this thing that you've been talking about, which is moisture. So do you want to talk about how moisture is part of the deal here?
One of the best ways to control a wide range of insect household pests is through desiccants. Things like, termites, famously, but cockroaches as well, using borate-based substances. There's a specific product which I have used called Timbor, which is basically a borate that you use to treat wood so that it's, again, an inhospitable environment for termites. And it works well for other insects as well.
It's also very important that you not have too much moisture to wood, soil to wood contact, that you get rid of that under the house where there's wood and moisture and stuff, because that's how these guys infiltrate, especially termites.
Some of the termites that, if their nest is in the ground, and that's how they get through it. If they're flying, then they just land.
All bets are off.
All bets are off. They'll find they'll take an opportunity to get into some bare wood, mm-hmm. and off they'll go.
But they don't like eating stuff that's been treated with Timbor. And it isn't true that you can't buy Timbor. You can buy Timbor. I know at least one place called Purity Products in Santa Rosa sells it. And it's cheap. We're going to need to just quickly ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're discussing healthy home inspections, which are actually available, but we're also trying to give you enough information so that you can scan your own environment. Again, healthy home inspections today. Yeah, it's one of the things I think is important question to ask when you rent a place or buy a place is whether or not the house has been tented.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I look for is if a house has been tented, by law it has to somewhere in the premises, there's supposed to be a notice posted in a reasonably visible place. Usually it's in a garage. Sometimes it's in the attics. And it will state when the treatment was done. And you want that date to be as long ago as possible, because the standard, and it will state what treatment it is, and usually the treatment is Vicane, which is a trade name. That's the Dow chemical trade name. The chemical is sulfonyl. I've completely forgotten what its chemical name is, but the common name is Vicane, and it's a neurotoxin. It takes a long time to outgas. And it is not benign stuff.
Yeah, the last time I did a show on this, what we discovered was that these gases are supposed to just rise above the house and drift away. Well, they rise above the house and they drift to the house next door in a lousy way, and they also infiltrate the wood structure of the house
and stay there. And they outgas, which is the whole, in terms of the theory of how it's supposed to work. That's what they're supposed to do. It's supposed to penetrate that's why you keep it tented for a day. It penetrates the wood, the material, and it not only kills off the insects that are in there, it outgasses and prevents further insects coming back. But honestly, the treatments do not last more than like a year. One guy told me, a contractor told me, he said there's two kinds of houses. There are houses that have termites, and there are houses that will have termites.
Well, most houses will have termites, especially houses that are subject to moisture will have termites. And the trick is, as you said, creating an inhospitable. It's a little bit like dealing with opportunistic funguses and molds in your body.
Yes.
You know, you just create an unpleasant environment for them, and they put their socks on and go away. So it isn't the case that a termite, either type, subterranean or the, what's the other one called? The ones that fly in. In any case, drywood termites.
Yeah.
That you have to bombard them with chemicals. I mean, they're not going to completely, it isn't like one of those cartoons, Hanna-Barbera cartoons or something, where the insects swarm in and they go chomp, 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 and then there's Swiss cheese for your house. It doesn't happen that fast. And you see them swarming, and you can determine how bad a situation you've got, and then you can figure out where they are and check the wood. Any new wood should be treated with Timbor. But anyway, that's a whole show to talk about that. But it's true of ants and roaches and wood boring beetles and all this other stuff you've listed here.
And understand, too, that they're very viable alternatives to tinting the house. And we've only mentioned one. There are many others.
Houseplants are a mixed blessing.
Houseplants hit you in two ways. Lots of houseplants create moisture, and remember, moisture is not your friend in terms of molds. Also, plants carry molds. Sometimes the potting soils carry molds. So those can be a problem, although not as serious as the black
mold
itself.
People also don't clean off their plants, so they're dusty.
Yeah. And there are some plants which are in themselves toxic. In one way or another, that you can be at risk from them, particularly kids or animals.
Yeah.
Some cats like to eat plants. They like little greens, maybe your dog, and there are some plants which are toxic, so you need to be careful about those. But it's also true that there are house plants that take pollutants out of the air.
So cool.
Golden pothos, for instance, takes benzene and formaldehyde out of the air. It's quite marvelous.
So
stuff.
Spider plants, another one that does
spider
plant coleus?
Takes. I think it takes benzene out.
Mm-hmm.
Arrowhead plant takes formaldehyde out. So there's quite a nice list.
And plants like spider plants don't require that much water, so you don't have to have moldy soil. You can choose plants that are not that wet.
Well, I think that the problem with house plants is if you have just a room filled with houseplants, you're going to be creating a lot of it's going to be a very moist environment, so it's going to be very inviting for molds. But just having, what, half a dozen plants in a room is not going to create a problem.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We are discussing healthy home inspections. I want to move on to, I note that there are issues with pets, particularly if you're using flea products on them,
right,
and flea control and all that stuff. And again, it's desiccants.
Yes, right.
But I want to move on to some of the materials that are inside a house that people can also make choices about. Again, this is, if you own a house, you have more choices than you do if you're renting, but one choice you have is carpeting.
Carpeting is...
Unless you're in one of these apartments with wall-to-wall, you know.
Carpeting is problematic in two ways. Carpeting is a very nice place for all the things you don't want to be exposed to hide. The dust mites, the fleas, the flea eggs. Very bad place for the little critters to hide. But the other thing that most carpeting... being synthetic does is it outgasses. It outgasses formaldehyde and other substances, and it does it forever. Underneath the carpet is going to be an underlayment of padding, typically, and that has formaldehyde in it, and that's going to be outgassing.
Forever also.
Forever as well. Now, chances are good that just because of it's so cheap to the synthetic carpets, that's what you've got on the floor. Now there's some ways you can check to just verify that it is. You can pull up like a corner of the carpet and take a look at the backing of the carpet, and if it looks like it's glued or that it is not woven, then that's a synthetic. For sure, synthetic carpet.
Can't you also just very gently touch a match to it, and if it...
Sure, that's the other way. You can take a piece of it and go outside. Don't do this inside. Because when you ignite this stuff, it produces things like dioxin.
Oh, God.
Want to take it outside and hold it far away from you and light a match to it, and it will curl and smoke, and it will smell, have a very strong... petroleum-like chemical smell, unlike a wool carpet or a cotton carpet, which will smell like burning hair.
And then there's glue.
And those glues. Well, the glues are actually more of an issue with vinyl flooring.
But there's a lot of glue in carpet, too. Carpet down.
Oh, because if you're on a slab as opposed to a frame flooring, joist and subfloor flooring, that you're on a cement slab, don't have a basement or crawl space underneath the house, then those carpets are generally glued onto the surface. But also just as I said, one of the ways to tell that a carpet is synthetic is that the material is glued to the backing of the carpet itself.
So there's glue there too. So, you know, the other thing that happens on floors a lot is that gone are the days, although you can still buy it, of natural linoleum. We just actually bought some natural linoleum. It was
great
really
stuff.
Interesting. Yeah, it's super stuff. But anyway, now we have vinyl. It's very, very cheap. But it's polyvinyl chloride.
It is polyvinyl chloride, and it has phthalates in it. And I think, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, one of the research project in Sweden uncovered a relationship between phthalates and asthma in homes. Now, the way that there are some older versions, I do not believe they can do this anymore, but there are some older versions of vinyl that has asbestos in it as well. And though it doesn't look like it, you're walking on this surface and it abrades and you'll get particles that are cast into the air.
It's that dust in the house again. It's full of chemicals.
Yes. And to add to this, typically Vinyl is installed with an underlayment, and that underlayment is almost invariably particle board, and it is glued to the particle board. The glues are toxic, and the particle board exudes formaldehyde. Again, forever, although because it's sealed, it's you are somewhat protected from the formaldehyde in the particle board itself.
Before we run out of time, can we talk about floors and ceilings, walls and ceilings? Walls and ceilings, we just finished with floors.
In older houses, probably one of the most important things to be cautious about is whether your walls are painted with lead-based paint. Ceilings, depending on if you've got one of these cottage cheese ceilings, again, there was a period when there was a lot of asbestos used in these materials. So there's a great deal of caution that one has to take in working with any of these materials. Although, if you've gotten some latex paint and painted over these, that tends to seal off the lead or the asbestos-containing materials.
And then you've got to worry about the paint that you're using and whether it's... Now they're putting in smell retardants to get rid of the VOC smell.
It's still there.
So the other trick
to VOCs is that the more color, just to know, the more color you have in the paint, the more VOCs you're going to have when you apply it.
We should talk. There's a lot here and not enough time. But it occurred to me that also people should pay attention to what they're bringing into the house. If you buy cabinets in your kitchen, could be particle board. Your furniture could have particle board in it. If you're sensitive, you can seal the ends of particle board with a plastic product of some sort. But the other thing is airing out stuff. Depending on your sensitivity, you can sit things out in the sun for a long time, but you can also try to buy things that are... Sometimes if they've outgassed long enough, if you buy them used or something, you can manage. It depends on how strongly sensitive you are. But I'd like to move into the whole issue of electricity and EMF inside the house and inside the office. We talked briefly about things like where your panel is on the house, but you're inside your office and you've got all this equipment. What other things? I mean, you've got the EMFs, and of course you've got fall off, so you can position things so they're far from you. You don't want to sit behind a computer. Always sit in front of a computer. I know that sounds stupid, but you can have more than one computer. But you have issues like the anyway.
Well,
and then you've got wireless, and we've got we've only got like 5 minutes. So.
Okay. The background to this, there's some basically suppressed research. It's not even suppressed. It's just was ignored and hasn't been funded, which started with Silicon Valley. In two places, Silicon Valley and electronics workers in Sweden. And the discovery here is that there's a synergistic relationship between EMF from computer equipment and the plastics and resins that are used to construct the things, so that sensitive people become what is called electro-hypersensitive. And when it gets that condition gets serious enough, people cannot go out in the sunlight. In fact, they can't even let light in at all. They have to sit in dark rooms. They can't survive any other way.
Wow.
So this is fairly serious business. There's two issues going on here. One is that any electrical current that goes through, that runs a motor, is going to create an electromagnetic field, so that the fan on your computer, which cools the thing down, is emitting electromagnetic radiation. And even though distance, it means that the only thing you want to have close to your body is the keyboard. The other equipment that you have hooked up to your computer needs to be not in a U around you, even though that makes you feel very secure. It needs to be in a straight line. In fact, even a straight line away from you, if you can deal with it. I mean, actually, it's some good exercise. You print something out, you get up, you go get the thing, and then you come back and sit down.
And ventilation is very important here, too. Air coming in windows, having windows that open and having air.
In the entire house, that's an extremely important issue. The other issue is there was just an article in the San Francisco Chronicle today about how there's a big move by telecoms to actively get rid of landline phone systems.
Oh, God.
By selling devices which will basically be Wi-Fi in your home, which will connect to the phone system. And they will sell cell phones which can hook to the Wi-Fi, which can link to the Wi-Fi or to the regular cell system. Those are the two kinds of exposures from office equipment which are the most serious. And then there's yet another, which I mentioned earlier, which is we've done a show on called dirty electricity, which is a phenomenon of increased frequencies because of overloading of electrical lines, that electricity comes into your house and creates what are called transients, and again creates electromagnetic fields which can affect you, which can affect health.
The main thing is don't put wireless in your house. I mean, just you don't need to. You can use a wired router for your cable and whatnot. Do not use wireless in your house.
Yes.
Anyway, all of this stuff can be mediated. I mean, the trick with finding, there's so much stuff we didn't even get into, a whole load of other things like the kitchen and where your hotspots in the house are and how to set things up so that you take the best advantage of which way you should face and ventilation and air and all that. And then we didn't even talk about forced air heating versus electric heaters and radiators and fireplaces, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole lot to think about in a healthy home inspection. And it is a reason for getting some help, but it's also a reason for just becoming more informed.
Indeed, I think a lot of this is common sense. Particularly, I think we all know that, maybe not realize it, but a refrigerator is a necessity. You have to have it, and yet it's one of the highest output of EMF in the house. But what that means is not that you should get rid of the refrigerator. It means that you should be prudent by doing work in the kitchen, positioning the refrigerator and doing your work in the kitchen so that you're no more than 3 feet away.
Well, thanks, Jeff Fawcett. Again, if people want to reach him directly, it's 707-874-1496. Healthy Home Inspections. Thanks again. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want to get a CD copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. You can reach Jeff Fawcett at 707-874-1496. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, transcripts, or the Progressive Health Observer, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen to the show all week long. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.